Behaviour 2010. So the fifth session, the first session of this morning, is on usability, and it will be chaired by Dave Clark. Dave.
We've just discovered doing this, but it doesn't take much advanced preparation since all I have to do is time five people for 10 minutes. We're going to do this in the order of the agenda, which I think means the three churches are
convening. I have just finished writing the slides. Security system, but you know, I don't think my mother could use it. Or my mother thinks about the design of systems like this. For every single damn UI I have to put in front of a security audience, I have to listen to them explaining to me that their mother wouldn't understand it. Now, if we think about this as a piece of rhetoric, it's really very clever. So, usability people go around saying you should produce concrete descriptions of your users, you should stop abstracting away from them. I may even have written a paper saying this. Now, it's very clever to pick the concrete example of your mother, because it's kind of offensive for me to walk up and say, actually, you're wrong. Your mother could do that. But when we study mothers, we find them doing all sorts of things you might not expect. So, one example was a mother we came across who liked to break VRM systems so that she could remix boy band videos to increase the homosexual connotations so that she could share them with other mothers. This is kind of pornography for mothers 2.0, right? Another mother I studied was very keen on breaking the RM system. She told me how she would go to the market and buy a knitting pattern off the shady guy who sold their 3.5-inch discs. Now, knitting patterns for knitting computers cost a ridiculous amount of money. They're about £60 for a bit of binary that tells a knitting machine where to knit. And they have all sorts of ghastly serial number protection. So she learned to take it home, open a hex editor, edit the bit streams off the top of the file, and then she could duplicate these disks and make a profit selling them on to the other mother's friends. So next time you invoke your mother, be prepared to answer questions about whether she does this. So really, I'm going to talk about security design discourse, not about the common criteria, you'll probably be glad to know. And this is really, as all of my talks in security and human behaviour seem to be, a kind of personal ramble as my life goes on to wherever it's going. So the first one, the first one led to a piece of work on generative usability. I then did some practical stuff. I spent about a year helping Talos build UIs for complex security systems. I'm now interning at Google, though I would strictly note that I have my academics hat on, so nothing I say should be taken as policy. And what I'm going to do is draw an analogy between privacy and security design discourse and graphic art. So, what can we learn about security and design discourse? Well, the gentleman sat over there spent one of the conferences I was at throwing things at people who were proclaiming doom. Now, there's a problem with worst-case reasoning, is the point he was making, I believe. If you take something like privacy or security, it's a very complex, very ill-defined problem. There are lots of kind of fluffy areas. So what we tend to do is pick one case, the worst case, argue that it's representative, and study it to death. So consequently, we have people building systems for things like security configuration for certificates. Whereas Cormac has taken to pointing out, nobody has ever been saved by a certificate warning, because the only people who have certificate errors on their sites are genuine websites. So consequently, by picking this single point, ignoring all of the rest, we burden our users with all sorts of garbage that they don't understand, don't care about, and actually should just click OK to. So one style of reasoning that we engage in that worked very well in systems security and works extremely badly in usability and end-user security is the worst case of representative of single point. So you collapse your cloud down into exactly that dot there. A very fractionally better, but not really much better, argument is the reduction to a metric. So, nice like that. That's a good one. So the reduction to a metric says, well, you know, it's not a single point. It's kind of a line, and lines are good, because if we have a single number, we can measure this line. So we forget all of the inconvenient complexity and reduce it down to a single measurable quality. You can pick anything with a number, key strength, you know, encryption status of a network line, whatever you like, it doesn't really matter. Because the point is that any single number does not capture the state, unless you have a number for how private you are, and I would dispute that such a number can exist. So this is typically accompanied by what the philosophers would call a reduction statement, or nothing butterly. So privacy is, no offense, Ben, I know you wouldn't say something as daft as this, privacy is nothing but linkability. And I'm sure you, Ben, of course, realises that privacy is more than linkability. It's just that that's one way of thinking about it. So, the point here is that any one of these reductions is an interesting way to think, but it's roughly like saying to a graphic designer, how good your graphic design is depends on the average amount of red on the page. So, this is a reduction of an emergent space to a single metric. This results, generally, in two communities who don't understand each other having a tug of war. So, the security community jump up and down and say, you have to do X, Y, and Z to make your system secure. And the usability end of the community, particularly the non-technical end of usability, say, you have to build this thing that, I don't care that computers don't work like that, build it anyway. And these two arguments, these two groups sit and yell at each other. So another example might be, I would assert that security is more important than climate change, so consequently we should encrypt everything on the planet. Someone else might assert the opposite. How are you going to settle this debate? Well, we don't teach graphic designers to settle this debate by attempting to measure the amount of red on a page and then measuring whether that's a good design or not. Basically, graphic design is so heavily imbued in social constructions of what's interesting, in complex representations of the visual system, etc., that we can't realistically turn it into a science. So instead, the way we educate graphic designers is as a graph trade. We show them hundreds, actually tens of thousands, of different things that were good graphic design in the past, and we have critical discourse around them. We critique them from various different perspectives. Now, if anyone actually said to one of these graphic designers, prove your critique is true, not a chance. But you collect so-called expert practice and teach it as a craft. So, my current work is to build Privacy Toolkit, which is a multiple perspectives of reasoning on the privacy problem, each perspective acknowledging its own limitations. So linkability is actually a really important thing that we need to understand, but we also need to understand what it doesn't tell us. So we build a critical discourse at the emergent level. We will build critical design theory from the experts in the field and acknowledge that we couldn't measure it and it wouldn't tell us anything even if we did. And this produces, hopefully, an outcome that is a design conversation rather than the Council of Athens that we tend to degenerate into at the moment. So we need a sort of critical appraisal of design. And if anyone has a good idea how to do that, please tell me.
Rob Reeder, right?
Yep. I'm Rob Reeder. I started studying usable security several years ago in graduate school, and now I have a really cool job, which is to basically take everything I learned from my PhD and put it into practice. Right now, I'm advising our engineers on how to build better software security warnings, and as part of that effort, I'm trying to figure out what to tell them, so I want to talk to you about some of that today. I want to focus you all on two questions about security warnings. So first, when should we show security warnings? And how do you design a good security warning? To motivate the problem that we're trying to address, let me show you this warning, which is from Internet Explorer 6. This is a warning you got for a particular kind of certificate problem when you've been checking the certificate for a website. You weren't able to check whether the certificate was revoked or not. So you got this warning saying revocation information for the security certificate for this site is not available. Do you want to proceed? Yes or no? Well, it turns out most users don't know what revocation information is. So this presents them with a really hard decision. There are four things that are really hard about this warning. First, there's the intimidating term, revocation information. Second, this doesn't say what might go wrong here. It doesn't even say that this might be a problem. Third, it gives no guidance to a user who's trying to make the right decision. And finally, it doesn't even make a recommendation. There's not even a default option selected here. So we really put users in a hopeless situation here. What ends up happening is most people say, well, I just want to go ahead and see my website, and they go ahead and click yes. They might worry that they did the wrong thing. So the result is they've done the same thing they would have done if we'd shown no warning at all, but the effect of the warning has been to make them feel bad about it. So to frame the discussion, let me just state what may be obvious, but a warning has two goals. First is to give the user a chance to stop a bad thing from happening right before it happens, so keep malware from getting installed or prevent the forfeiture of your personal information. The second is if they know that they're in a safe situation, the warning should allow them to proceed and get on with their digital life. So thanks to the work of many in this community, we know that warnings often don't achieve these goals. Nobody likes warnings, and that's because they're so often ineffective. And warnings can be ineffective for a variety of reasons, which we know from our literature. They interrupt users from their primary tasks. No one wants to be interrupted to manage security when they're in the middle of browsing the web. They habituate users. People see so many warnings, they just get used to them and just ignore all warnings. And even for those users who are conscientious and really want to do the right thing when they see a warning, the warnings make no sense. They don't give people even an opportunity to do the right thing. So I'm here to assert, though, that warnings actually could be effective if we just did a better job of designing them. And that, moreover, designing a good warning is not just a matter of luck, but it's an engineering process. That, in fact, there are common elements to warnings, and if we figure out what those elements are, and educate engineers on how to include them in their security warnings, that engineers can build better warnings and do so consistently. So I want to motivate the rest of the talk with two examples of warnings. First is this one from Office Before 2010. This is a warning which I think we saw in somebody's talk yesterday that comes up when you have a link to external content in a PowerPoint presentation. So the external, we saw this yesterday, right? Yes. And everyone said, click cancel, click cancel. One funny thing about that is that when you're making this, when the user is presented with this decision, it's often helpful to see the non-external content of the presentation before you know whether you need that extra external content or not. But this warning got shown as soon as somebody opened the file rather than once they had seen what's in the file. So there are two big problems with the warning. First is that it's being shown at the wrong time. The user has to make a decision before they really have all the information they need to make it. Second is that even the users who don't need the external content, as was the case with Bill yesterday, have to see the warning and deal with it. So let me show how we redesigned this in Office 2010. So now we use this gold bar experience where we load the presentation, we load all the content that can be loaded safely, and then put this gold bar up in the periphery at the top of the window. So now, users who don't need, every user gets to see the whole presentation, as at least all the safe material, before they need to make a decision on whether they need that extra external content. And for those users who don't need that extra content, they never have to deal with the interruptive warning. They can just ignore the gold bar. For those who do need it, they can just go up to the gold bar and get the external content they need. So we think this is a much better warning experience than the interruptive one that I showed just before. So as a second example, I'm going to go back to that one I showed at the top of the talk. This is a pretty bad warning for the reasons I mentioned. But we could do a much better job designing this. And starting with Internet Explorer 7, I think we did. So this is the certificate warning that you'll get in Internet Explorer today. And it improves on those big problems that are in the revocation information dialog. So for starters, it starts with very plain language. It says there is a problem. Any user can understand that. Most users don't understand revocation information. It explains what could go wrong. It says this may be an attempt to fool you or intercept your data. Again, very simple concepts that any user can understand. It makes clear what choices are available. It says you can close the web page or continue to the website. And it actually makes a recommendation, as indicated by the green shield versus the red shield, and the words not recommended in parentheses. And finally, something I really like about this warning, and I think a lot more warnings need to have, are some actual actionable steps a user can take to reduce risk. So to just point to a specific one here, the third bullet says, if you choose to ignore this error and continue, do not enter private information into the website. So that's a step that anyone, whether they're a security expert or not, whether they understand what a certificate is or not, can do to help reduce their risk. So let me point out something about the cert warning, which Cormac has made famous, is that almost all of the time when we show the cert warning, it's a false alarm. It's usually a legitimate, you usually get it because you're going to a legitimate website that has misconfigured its certificate or let its certificate expire. So a potential solution to reducing the annoyance of warnings is maybe to just take action automatically. For the cert warnings, maybe we should just go to the site and just not show a warning at all. I think there's an argument for that, and I'm actually interested in hearing all of your perspectives on it. But there are also arguments against. If we stop showing warnings at all, this whole cert infrastructure is kind of useless if you don't ever surface it to users. There are always those fringe cases where there actually is an attack happening and you want to give people a chance to get out of it. And most importantly, the cert warnings are kind of an unusual scenario. There are actually, most of the times when we show a warning, it's really not at all clear cut. So we know, for example, for file downloads, email attachments, some people do pick up malware this way. These sometimes contain attacks, but obviously they're often legitimate as well. We really don't know what to do, so we often need to bring the user in to help us make the right decision. So I don't see, in the short term at least, getting away from showing warnings today. If people have ideas for how we can totally get away from showing warnings, I'm definitely interested in hearing. So let me tell you what we're telling our engineers now as far as guidance for designing warnings. First, don't warn if you don't have to. So if you can open a file in a sandbox where it'll open safely, do that. Use those gold bar experiences where you do as much safe stuff as you can before you force the user to make a decision. And second, though, if you have to show a warning, at least design it well enough so that you enable users to make correct decisions. And that means giving them enough information to make a good decision, so giving them enough context about the decision they're being asked to make, and also giving them a few steps of guidance to make a good decision, and making sure there's some realistic set of steps they can follow in both benign and malicious scenarios, so they can both avoid the bad things and continue to do the good things they want to do. So I want to close with a few questions that I think this audience might help answer, maybe through discussion or maybe through some future research. First is, when should we warn? What are those contexts in which a warning is appropriate, and when do we not need to warn? Maybe there are times today when we're warning and we actually don't need to. Third is the advice we're giving right? We're telling engineers that if we put effort into writing good warnings and making them actionable, that we will improve the situation. But it may be the case that when you interrupt users from primary tasks, they won't pay attention no matter how good your warning is. It'd be great to know whether it's useful to continue along the whole warning paradigm that we've got, or whether an entirely different approach is needed. And finally, I think the biggest question I have is, what can we realistically ask users to decide? So is it possible that warnings can help people make good security decisions, or do we need different paradigms entirely? Maybe we need to be more paternalistic and make more decisions for users. Or maybe we need to better educate users about security so that we're not always in these last-ditch attempts to get people out of bad situations with warnings. So thanks, that's all I have to say. And I hope that you'll all contribute to a discussion about this during the discussion section.
All
Yeah, so what I want to talk about is sort of like it's a reflection, looking back at almost 15 years of trying to do usable security. And also basically I want to be a bit sort of like provocative and say like I just don't think the way we're going about it at the moment is the right way and it's going to get us there. So I started this area it's nearly 15 years ago being called in, and I've told this story before into a company which basically had problems that the cost of help desks for resetting users' passwords were running out of control. Basically, they trebled every year over 3 years, and the accountants were saying, guys, where's this going? No one's a problem. So this was in 1996. And when they basically asked us to come in and do a study, you know, the only thing we got was, why can't these stupid users remember their passwords? Notice the emphasis on the, you know, on the adjective. And I think that attitude still, unfortunately, largely prevails. You know, like if it's not working, it's because people are stupid. I think it's helpful, and I think we need a more fundamental shift, you know, and rethink of that whole interaction and who's actually in charge here. So what we pointed out is like, you know, in this case, the answer is what was, you know, the users aren't stupid, you're asking them to do things that are impossible to do. You know, no human being can have, you know, between 16 and, you know, minimum 16, maximum 65 different passwords, you know, that basically have to be 6 to 8 characters long and very strength and not write them down and have them different for all the system memory. It's just, you know, unless you're somebody like Martin, you know, who can train themselves to do really, you know, incredible feats. It's just not, you know, it's not going to happen. So what did they do when they were faced with security policies? You know, basically, they're trying to get their work done, and if they basically what they have to do for security is disruptive and work their kind of difficult, they will try and find shortcut. You know, they essentially use this violate security as a shortcut because they're just trying to get the job done and they're looking for the fastest way there. And I think that particular lesson is still not really being sort of heeded. And something I think also thing that we said in that paper that still people, you know, a lot of people in the community don't understand is that the consequence of this is that you fundamentally poison the relationship between users and security. Right? If they always see it as an obstacle that gets in the way of getting important things done, and then if they do the shortcuts, the security department retaliates with stricter policies, you know, with monitoring them more and slapping them more, then the whole way of how people look at security is that it's nothing but a pain in the neck, you know, that stops you from getting things done. And it's not something that's worth, you know, treasuring, being, you know, that they just don't believe it's there for them. They just don't believe it's worth making any effort for it. You know, it's something that's just there to annoy them, you know. But what you get as a result of that is a relative disaffection. You know, if you listen to our social scientists here, we had a couple of talks yesterday, is you have an adversarial stance between users and security, users and the security people. And basically that's why we call this paper, users are not the enemy. It's because there was a state of war between the security department and the rest, you know, of normal users in the company. And with an adversarial stance, you will always have enormous costs trying to achieve the level of security that you believe is necessary. If you get a collaborative stance between the different parties, it's always going to be much, much cheaper to achieve your goals, you know. So really, we need to get out of this, and I still don't think we have. We just published a paper earlier this year where we said, like, okay, it's like more like 10 years later. We went back into a couple of other organizations and looked at this again. So we essentially asked people to do diaries, where we asked them to write down every time they had to use a security mechanism during the, or had to authenticate during the day, basically then they'd say what was the main thing you were doing at the time, you know, and how disruptive was it, did it fail, why did it fail, and then we went and looked at all, you know, and still basically so the good news, the only good news from the point of view of the security people in the study was, is that compared to our users 10 years earlier, there was an increased awareness of the risks, and there was a better understanding generally amongst users of what the risks of not following, you know, of basically like sharing your password around, and so what those risks might be. So that was good. But in terms of everything else, you know, I can't really see much difference. So we recommended in the earlier study, is this, we said the number of different passwords is ridiculous. Nobody can code, you know, single sign-on surely must be a way forward. And what's depressing to find, what we found was that despite both of these organizations having deployed single sign-on, the actual workload associated with authentication was still as high as it was 10 years ago. Because what you're getting in organizations is, you know, particularly with outsourcing services, you get lots of third-party services coming in, and they can't be reconciled with the SSO that the organization has deployed, you know. And so with increasingly of buying things in, you know, the security department is even losing control and can't put a unified policy for authentication onto the various servers because Wolters and Bloomberg are just not going to listen to what you're doing. There's a number of new vulnerabilities emerging. Basically, password reuse and sharing is random. Cormac, one of your earlier studies basically showed, you know, each password is reused on average across at least four different services, and where most people are savvy enough to say, this is a really, you know, my online banking password, maybe I shouldn't reuse that password anywhere else. But for things they perceive to be less sensitive, they still do. Other thing is, like, you know, the reminders, basically. So the easiest target for an attacker, in my view, is now is just break into the email account, you know, which very often is quite easy to break into, and then you'll find a folder there. So basically users now just preemptively get password reminders from all sorts of services and store them in a mail folder, so that when they can't remember the password, they just go to the mail folder and look up the reminder message and type it in. So, you know, all their passwords are basically sitting there. And we found that the impact on individual skills and tasks for cost for the organization was still enormous. You know, there wasn't really a marked improvement on what we found 10 years ago. So, I mean, there's typical sort of like badly implemented single sign-on where, yes, you have the same password, but you still have to type it 35 times during the day. You know, when somebody locks themselves out, the kind of infrastructure basically means it'll take a minimum of 2 hours for the password to reset across the various systems. So if that was something you really needed to get done, you know, you have to wait even to get a password reset. And really, the organization is still more obsessing, both of these organizations, about the costs of doing the resets and trying to minimize them by all means possible. But, you know, I would say, if you're interested, you can look at it in more detail in the paper. I'd still say, you know, it wasn't really, you know, the security hadn't markedly improved. There's still lots, you know. So basically, the users still aren't happy, you know, it's lots of work, and there's still vulnerabilities all over the place, and there are new ones creeping up. You know, basically, there's a lot of ad hoc password creation required for shared, you know, for various shared files and shared systems. And, you know, basically people just put fairly weak passwords onto a Word document, you know, with very sensitive content and email it all over the place, and they're not really aware. You know, basically a lot of that stuff isn't captured by the security policies at all at the moment. So, I mean, where's the problem? You know, I still think part of the problem is still this attitude. It's like, you know, you've got, like, you know, all this fantastic technology on one side, and then you've got, you know, the stupid user, you know, who just commits human error in the other side. And then sort of like that leads to this kind of thinking, like, if only we could, you know, educate the users more, we could fix the problem. And in my view, this is not, you know, the place to start. The education has to be saved for, you know, the very, very few cases where really you need that active engagement and collaboration, because you can't design it, you know, to not be a problem in the first place. And I think it's the design of security solutions and how we think about where security sits that still is the problem. So, you know, basically designers have to accept that human behavior is essentially goal-driven, right? People don't go through life to do security. You know, they're trying to get job signed, they get from A to B. And, you know, sort of, if you've got, like, you know, if you can't remember your PIN, you know, and it's like this, you know, people will just drive around. So what do? We put up bigger barriers for them to make it harder to do that. You know, but if you think about it, you know, so these are basically for public transport, you know, revenue protection is not the primary goal, you know, and I think it's a lousy solution. The primary point of public transport is to get people from A to B. So putting barriers in the way that stop people from running and catching a train, you know, they might just get, you know, is just not helpful. You know, having fare structures that mean people spend 15 minutes, you know, helplessly punching various buttons on a ticket machine trying to get it out. It's not that kind of, you know, that kind of design. It's just not, that's not effective security. You know, what's wrong with putting the ticket machine on the train, you know, so people can buy their ticket when they're on there? Or, as we have in continental Europe now, you know, you can buy them from your mobile phone. You know, basically putting these big barriers up is just not a thing. And I think here is an example, you know, again, when they introduced chip and pin in Europe and asked people, you know, basically a couple of years later, do you think chip and pin is a good idea? So you basically, when you pay with your credit card, you have to punch a pin in. So, and they were very relieved when most of the customers said, yes, we think it's a good idea. Then the next question was, why do you think it's a good idea? What do you think was the most frequent answer?
So they can't just send
the cards. Yeah, so because now I can send the kids, give the cards and the pin to the kids and send them shopping. And when I had to sign for it, I couldn't do that. You know, it's a payment method and, you know, basically various things like, you know, basically I think Amazon is starting to realize that, you know, that we need to look for more creative solutions. Thanks.
So, I'm going to talk about something that is not usually discussed in polite society. Where do security policies come from? I mean, my animation is working so well, but that red line, pretend you don't see it at the moment. So, usability is all about trade-offs. We know this, yes, Scott, and Brian. The problem with that is we're going to trade usability for security, but we don't really know how to measure security, right? We don't know how to measure it at all. We don't really know how to measure usability either. And we certainly don't know how to trade off either of these against each other. So basically, we kind of, you know, talk past each other and never really make any progress. So we don't really know how to do those trade-offs in a systematic way. But yet we do make those trade-offs in the sense that, you know, lots and lots of different places must come up with policies of one kind or another. Here's the password policy from a government to U.S. government site, weather.gov, where they want, you know, your password to be changed every 180 days, 12 characters long, blah, 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 the usual stuff, you know, the stuff that's kind of easy to make fun of. And this is, you know, to support an instant messaging program which gets you at, you know, weather updates, basically. So where does this junk come from? I mean, you know, apart from the point of, you know, making fun of the obvious kind of, you know, how difficult this is, where does this come from? I mean, it's serious. I mean, someone sat down, someone came up with this. And I don't mean to make fun of their mind. It's like, what was in their head? Why did they come up with this policy and no other policy? Why is it not stronger? Why is it not weaker? There's some set of, you know, constraints that they thought they had in mind. And I want to try to figure out, what did they have in mind and how did they get there? And that's what I want to get to. And so it's difficult for us to, you know, to figure out, you know, systematically how these trade-offs are made. But one thing is, these trade-offs are made by a lot of different people in a lot of different places and a lot of different websites. And maybe by studying the properties that the compromises that different people have made, we can get some insight into what's important for different people. So what Danae and I did is we gathered the password policies of 75 websites that we found, you know, 15 top traffic websites, 10 high traffic medium, the 10 largest financial institutions in the US, 10 largest universities, top 10 ranked CS departments. That was kind of cynical because we thought those were the people who were reviewing our paper, and the top 10 ranked .gov sites. And so we opened accounts at, you know, a majority of these actually, or just over a majority. The rest we have to rely on public password policies. And so then what we wanted to do is look at, and you know, I'm reducing everything to a one-dimensional spectrum here, but for all those password policies, I'm just taking one number, which is the minimum bit strength of the policy. And I know that that's not a great measure, but it's, you know, it's good for these purposes. So that is, you know, the minimum length that they take times log 2, the minimum cardinality of the set. So for example, if you're allowing a 6-digit PIN, which allows numbers, that's a 19 or a 20-bit password. If you want, you know, 8 characters and it's up or lower, blah, 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 it's 52 bits. So that's the measure I'm taking of these 75 sites that I'm looking at. And what I want to do is figure out which sites are asking for stronger stuff and which for weaker. And when we figure out the characteristics of the site, that can't correlate with the strength that they demand. So the first thing is that across the 75, there's just an enormous diversity of requirements. I mean, starting from, you know, there's some really low ones here where kind of content sites that, you know, that don't really protect very much. But, you know, places like Amazon and PayPal tend to be in here around the 20 bits in the current industry. And then it goes all the way up to, as I said, our friend weather.gov, which is like 77 bits. And I mean, it's easy to get a laugh out of this, but the laugh, I want to get something more than a laugh out of this, which is, you know, why does weather.gov require, you know, 2 to the power of 50, that is, you know, about 10 to the power of 15, more resistance to brute forcing than Amazon.com? Why is that? Because, you know, and that's what I want to figure out. We're not alone. There are others out there. So what we did is we started to look at all of the factors that we thought might affect the need to have greater security. And there are a bunch of them, and let me just kind of quickly show you, you know, one or two. And we didn't find any such correlation. We don't find that the people that you'd expect to have greater security requirements, that this correlates at all with the strength of the passwords that are. So, for example, number of user accounts, I mean, how big a site is. Well, that, you know, the bigger you are, the more you're going to be attacked, and the more vulnerable you are to statistical guessing attacks on passwords. Well, we did not find the correlation. We found a kind of negative correlation. The really large guys, like Facebook, Yahoo, Live, Gmail, Twitter, have, you know, hundreds of millions of accounts, and they have the weakest, you know, some of the weakest policies that we found in our study. Whereas you look at, say, you know, the university site that I chose, the top universities, these have been on the order of tens of thousands of users, extremely strong policies, so no correlation, actually negative correlation. What about things like the value of assets, another rather obvious one? Well, they're just more guided. You look at places like, you know, the banks definitely slightly stronger than, you know, Hotmail and Gmail, but, you know, Bank of America, $2.2 trillion under management. Fidelity, $1.4 trillion under management, allows a choice of bid policy, one of the weakest policies that you find PayPal, very tax sign, again, somewhat. So it's not, you know, value of assets. I know it's hard to compare across classes here, you know, what are the value of assets at Ohio State or a small university, but it certainly ain't, you know, the $2.2 trillion that these guys have. Another thing that is, a measure of how, you know, the assets there may not give you a measure of how easily those assets are attracted, but there is something that we can use for a proxy on how easily assets can be extracted, which is how attacked the site is along other avenues. So if you look at how phished sites are, and this is a list of produced by Alexa, the most phished brands on the web, and it starts with PayPal, Chase, the usual suspects. These are the guys. These are just fish. But they allow, and the parallel I'm trying to draw here is it's a little implausible to think that somebody is attacked a great deal by fishers and not at all by brute forcers. So it's a reasonable proxy to say these guys are being attacked for credentials. They're being attacked by fishers, but if there's brute forcing going on, they're also being attacked by that. And yet the guys at the top of the list have, you know, relatively moderate policies. And some of the people with the strongest policies out there just don't figure at all. And there are several other ones that we tried, but no correlation that we can find between the things that you might imagine to require stronger policies and increase bid strength. So what's going on? And so when we look at this, we kind of say, well, what is the force that pushes these guys over on the right hand of the graph to choose these stronger policies? And, well, maybe I'm looking at this the wrong way. There is also a force, presumably, that pushes things in the other direction that makes people try to make things more usable and less onerous. Maybe we should be looking at that. And so we actually started tabulating that, and then we start to make some progress. So one of the things we looked at is, does a site accept advertising? That is, will they sell paid advertising? This is splitting that same histogram that was on the last slide out. The blue is the guys that accept advertising, the red is the ones that do not. And if there's an enormous difference. This is the median policy strength across those that accept advertising is about 20, those that do not is about 40, 2 to 20 difference. Another advertising is, do you purchase AdWords? Do you go and solicit traffic by paying Google to make sure that the first link that comes up when you use your top-level domain, that comes up to be you? Again, almost exactly the same. But those people who are actively soliciting traffic, who are paying for traffic, tend to have far lower policies. And there are several others like this. Does the user have a choice? And by choice, I mean, does the user have a choice? A choice is provided at the time of account creation. At Facebook, for example, you can choose not to use Facebook, or you can choose to use some other social network site. At Amazon, you can always choose to buy from another retailer. Whereas, if you're at Ohio State, well, Ohio State is really, their web services are the monopoly provider of web services of a certain kind to Ohio State students. They really don't have a choice about it.
And when we tabulate that, this is an histogram of those where people have a choice, far, far lower, and then those where they do not have a choice, they're on the high end of the spectrum. So, I mean, a pattern is starting to emerge here. Here's the histogram, you know, the overall histogram of the thing. And this is when I split it out by, you know, .coms, .edus, and .govs. And again, it becomes just very, you know, I mean, almost mind-blowing, but the .coms are down at the bottom here with a big, you know, lump center kind of around 25th. And then the .edus and the .govs are up on the top. So what's going on here? And what I think is going on, correlation is not causation, but here's my conclusions that I draw from it, is that, you know, things don't end up in a particular place because there's no inherent reason why, you know, this policy is the only policy that will do. It's not that people were able to derive it. We don't have analysis tools that will write it. The way things end up the way they are is that there are forces that reach equilibrium to bring them to that point. There's always a force that demands more security and pushes things forever up. There's also a force that demands more usability and pushes things down. And at any given site, where those two forces reach equilibrium is where things end up. And those two forces are not equally strong in all different places. So weather.com or weather.gov does not have greater security requirements than Amazon. It's simply the case that they are better insulated from the consequences of poor usability. The pain that they drop on their users does not show up as pain directly to them. At weather.gov, there's, you know, of course, demands for security, but it's hard to see that their demands for security are greater than Amazon, or greater than Fidelity, or greater than Google. But it is the case that every time somebody logs in at Amazon.com, they're a revenue opportunity. Every time they log in at weather.gov, they're at best a matter of indifference, and at worst, they're actually a cost. So when it comes to where do security policies come from, I say that, Adam Smith can actually teach us more about, you know, where this stuff comes from and who's got it right than any security expert. Because he suggests that the invisible hand dictates that organizations that exist in a competitive environment make better resource allocation decisions than ones that are affected by a monopoly. And the guys at the bottom, Amazon and PayPal and Fidelity, they make it work. They're among the most attached, the largest sites out there. They make it work. And the guys who are significantly higher than that really are just indulging in overshoot at their users' expense. And if you want to see, and it's passwords are somewhat unique in that we have a one-dimensional visible spectrum where these two can come straight off. But in other places, if you want to know how likely is it that I have some security overshoot of what I'm doing, well, a good question to start is how coercive is the relationship that this organization has with its users? How much choice do the users have in choosing to deal with them or not? That's it. Thank you.
Hi.
Simple English Wikipedia version of it. So we'll be giving it to you sentence by sentence. So the conventional wisdom, we're still in the world where the only way we really authenticate people on the web is by asking them to enter something they remember that's secret. Everything else we have is really expensive, so people don't do it. It's very good for security theater and science fiction novels, but not for the internet. The technical point I want to make, which I'll try and go through as quickly as possible, it's really only so that the pretty graphs I want to show later will be make more sense. Computer scientists in the room will know what entropy is. Other people might not. That's actually good, because entropy is sort of the wrong way to think about how secure is some secret that someone has remembered and is supposed to enter into a site. So I'll throw out a question to illustrate the difficulty of this problem, which I did in financial crypto too, so I'll be curious to see if the audience has a different opinion here. But suppose we're designing some security system for the web, and we can either make users remember a randomly chosen four-digit PIN, or we can make them enter a surname. So we can ask, say, what was your first grade teacher's name? Which one of those is better? Which one is harder for an adversary to guess? Who would think the surname is harder to guess?
Is the pen chosen by the user or chosen by a computer?
Chosen by a computer. Okay, so we have pretty low.
It's more than 10,000 common teacher names.
More than 10,000 common teacher names.
So some people
50% of them are Smith or James. Yeah.
So I'll give you more information. If you like entropy, the entropy of a surname is actually higher.
Right.
But of course, I'm going to argue that that doesn't give us the complete picture. So entropy, if you've never seen it before, entropy was invented in the 1940s to measure how difficult it was to compress information and send it over a wire. It was not okay. So discovered or invented? I guess that's real soft.
After thermodynamics.
This is Shannon entropy or information entropy. Anyway, it was never really intended to have anything to do with security, but it's been co-opted for security. There's also the concept of guessing entropy, which measures actually much more directly what's the expected number of guesses that you would need to guess something if you do it sequentially. That is, you guess the most likely thing and then the next most likely thing in order. If you do this, it looks like a randomly chosen pin is going to be much, much easier to guess, just because the space is much, much smaller. And there are some really unusual surnames out there that essentially skew this whole number and make it look like it's quite difficult to guess a surname on average. The problem is that if you change to a more real-world attacker who, say, wants only a 50% chance of getting the right answer, all of a sudden, the two things start to look equal. It takes about the same number of guesses to have a 50% chance of success with a randomly chosen pin or a surname. And if you lower that even further, if you say we only want a 10% chance of being right, then all of a sudden the surname starts to look really bad because you don't have to get out of the extremely common names before you get to 10%. So this is a leftover from my financial crypto paper, another big formula that doesn't really matter. But you can design a much better metric that's much more targeted to this attacker who wants some certain chance of being correct. And you can even convert it to a logarithmic space so it looks just like entropy. I was actually so proud of Cormac because he said bit strength for how strong passwords are, which is exactly the way we should be thinking about it. We're trying to take a really fuzzy notion of security and convert it to units of bits because computer security researchers like bits. So, just to show you, if you have a uniform distribution or a skewed distribution with this metric, the traditional entropy, guessing entropy, and my new measure all say that that's equivalent to 4 bits, so that makes sense. But if you notice here, for the really skewed distribution with one really, really common answer, if you have an attacker who only needs a 50% chance of success, this all of a sudden is really weak. It's equivalent to just 1 bit. If you need a success rate of 75%, this is actually better than this distribution. So I think this is the right way to reason about it. And the best thing is that you can graph it and really get most of the picture. So with this skewed distribution I just showed you, the really skewed thing is terrible. If you need any success rate less than 50%, and then it quickly gets to be more difficult to guess. So that was the mathematical background I needed to give you, I think, to really show how to answer this question of pin versus surname. It depends on what the attacker wants. And they actually cross over right around the 50% mark. So a surname is much weaker for an attacker who wants only some low probability of success, and if you absolutely have to guess the thing, the surname is a lot worse because you may get stuck with some really uncommon surname. And there are lots of theorems. I kind of just put these in as a joke. I was worried I would be the first talk in the morning, so I thought I needed theorems. Okay, now hopefully the more fun part of the talk. People aren't good at remembering things to enter into security systems. So we have a whole bunch of systems that are based on humans remembering something and inputting it. Password and personal knowledge are the common ones, but there's also obviously pins, and then there's a variety of graphical systems. I tried to gather all the literature I could so that I could compare these. So the reason that these are just points here and not lines like I had for pin and surname is that we actually, so these are different graphical schemes, different password sets that have been leaked, mnemonic passwords. We just have individual data points. To do the personal knowledge stuff, I crawled all of Facebook and got a lot of government statistics so that I could estimate how difficult it is to guess things like last names and first names. You can see that these come in slightly under the passwords, the password world and the graphical password world. The good news that happened about 6 months ago, there's a gaming website called Rockyou that got hacked. This is Rockyou if you've never seen it. It's a social gaming website. And they leaked a list of 32 million passwords out into the wild, which is kind of controversial because this is sort of a stolen list of passwords, but I think it is worth using for research because adversaries will certainly use it. And if you've never looked at raw password data, it's really, really fun to see what people do. So this is the laughing at users portion of the usability talk. There's some funny stuff. Just to show you some of the things I like, you can see if you sort by things that people love, you see me is the third most popular thing. And you also have Jesus and God and boys and Chris. If you look at what people don't like, you end up with AOL and emo. And you can even use this as an oracle to see what people think about you. I think people have the right idea about me based on how they feel. But the serious thing here is that the number of people who pick a password that's used by a huge number of other people is surprisingly high. So this is just that somewhere in the middle of the distribution, things that you... A user could very reasonably think they're the only person using, like, say, Snuggles or Mookie. There's 1,000 other people using that. And it's actually a pretty sizable chunk of users. 35% are using a password that at least 1,000 other people in the world are using.
On that site.
Yeah. It gets worse if you consider at all, right? So if we add that into our plot, this is why it's helpful to have the success rate thing, because there is a big chunk of passwords that actually end up being fairly good when you get up to the 20-bit space. But notice how, compared to the name distribution, the password distribution really, really crashes on this left-hand side.
Wait, I mean, isn't this an extremely low security? I mean,
why? Yeah, yeah. probably we should get to that in questions. I have a longer response. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to show you is something I think the one data line I don't have on that big graph that I really want is how people pick pins for banking. We don't have any data sets that have ever been leaked on this. We have some very small surveys that aren't significant. So I designed my own experiment, which was extremely sophisticated, which was to grep the Rockyou passwords for where people have entered a four-digit number, just to see what people do. And you see, similar to the way people pick passwords, you see some really funny things people do. They like 6969, they like 1234, they really like years. When you plot these like this, you see some trends you might expect. People like things with repeated digits. This is the years. This is everything that can be represented as a four-digit date. And when I add that into my plot, I get quite concerned about pins. This is, I guess, kind of my future research area, is to think of a better way to figure out how people do pins in the real world. Like I said, this is just a graph. It's not real pins. But there's reason to suspect that if people pick from within the very, very small space of pins, as in as skewed of a manner as they do for the much larger space of passwords, the pin, I think, could be a lot weaker than we've thought.
What
are the
points on your graph?
Which is here on slide 17 or 15.
Yeah, I noticed that.
It really threw me off.
Was your question was the...
I'm trying to understand what the points actually mean, because...
Okay, the points, so these came out of studies. This is basically the translation of somebody who did a dictionary attack, and they said, so this point would be we had a dictionary of 1 million entries, and based on that, we were able to crack 25%. Again, the reason these are points is because these came out of academic papers where they don't try every incremental dictionary. They just try a couple of general dictionaries. So
we're now in the question session.
I think my data is from MySpace passwords.
Sure.
My data is from MySpace.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I comment a lot in the mornings. I don't know much about security. There's evidence that I need to be advised about it. But you might want to look at the literature outside, the warnings literature outside of security. There's a lot of work that's not too dissimilar in its basic principles. How do you get people to heed warnings to earthquakes and for hurricane evacuation, survival, tornadoes, and so forth? There's a vast literature that my issue could draw some insights from. A key person to start with, very brutal, is Dennis Millay. He's quite an approachable guy. If you wanted to send him now and tell him what you're good, he could give you his birthday.
Huh? Or is it?
Well, he's had the Disaster Center of Colorado for a lot of years. Retired to be a professor. He's still very active.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him. We certainly are familiar with that.
And the other thing would be Cass Sunstein. That strikes me as his arguments about why do we have reasonable default values that are instructive, but if you don't know what to do, default values are a lot better than what you do.
So I can see the usability answer to this question is really simple. If you accept users trying to achieve a goal, so they're looking at a website, and let's say they're trying to buy some Tiffany earrings, right? And they come across a website that says we have Tiffany earrings at 75% off, right? And so you can't really afford the proper to pay the price of the Tiffany welcome website, but now you're looking at a website that you think you can get them for 75%. The only thing that's going to prevent the user from going to that website, it's not going to be a warning that says, oh, a certificate error, or it's 80% likelihood this website's back. The only thing that will stop the user is a warning that says, if you buy from this website, you're not going to get any Tiffany earrings. And that's the first thing you have to tell them. And on top of that, you might have your credit card details stolen, et cetera, et cetera.
It has to be reliable.
And that's quite consistent with the warnings literature on how you really get people to evacuate now. There's statistics that you say, and so forth. It's quite actually.
I'd like to point out that this is a really interesting scenario, but there are lots of scenarios in which warnings appear, and we have to be as conscious of those cases where it's a perfectly safe situation as we are of the cases where we really need to stop people from doing something. Yeah. That's where it's really hard. We show some warning, but we're 99% sure, you should not be doing this. And then we can do tricks like hiding the exit options. It's those cases where maybe it's a 10% chance there's something bad happening here, or that's a really hard situation.
Well, you're like, what to do it, but you're going to help you guys with me.
We succeeded yesterday.
Yeah,
A related question. You're suggesting recommendations in the face of uncertainty. And does this bother your lawyer? Because you can get it wrong two ways. You could be blocking the legitimate site for Tiffany earrings and they would have a case against you. Or if you make a recommendation the other way and something disastrous happens to my sister. In a litigious society, I'm wondering what your lawyers have to say about it.
On behalf of all the lawyers at Microsoft, actually, you're getting on a lot of the really sticky issues with they're actually more secular than just the user. And we have to take other interests into consideration, which makes it even harder. I mean, we just had to consider the user. You can already see how hard it is to design the user. It's something that's really ambiguous.
Sort of a question or a comment for Joe. I like what you're doing on that with trying to come up with some meaningful measure of what things are really worth. And there are two things that you were talking about, both the fit strength and the degree to which things are used that are kind of at opposition to each other. I once on one of these sites where you select a secret question and select a secret answer was extraordinarily clever because when I was in college, a friend of mine and I created for a comedy sketch a fake language, and it had structure but no content. It was designed to be completely meaningless. So I selected my question and my answer from this fake language that we did, and only two people in the world know this and remember it. But sometime years later, for giggles, I Googled the question, and there were exactly two hits, both of which include the answer. So despite the fact that only two people in the world know this question, it has 0 bits of entropy and 0 bits strength to it. So you know, there is a chance that you know, I would say that you know, the problem with some of this is it Googleable. That you know, this is both how Palin's email and Obama's Twitter accounts were gotten into, was by Googling notable information about them and cutting down the search space. I can broke into Palin's email account only to make one guess which high school of two she went to.
So, that's a great point. I think that the reference on that is Stuart Schechter's paper last year, which involved having people who knew the person who registered the security question really well guess it. Of course, before it would do this quite frequently. I guess, if you're in that scenario, it really doesn't matter what space the thing is drawn from. But if you assume the attacker doesn't know the individual or is trying to guess thousands of people at the same time, then I get into the bit strength world.
I've got a counter answer to Cormac. You said a competition makes people responsive to users, and you know, you certainly got a strong libertarian argument, but I'm going to go back to Chris's talk from yesterday and say the banks don't care what happens to you. If you lose money, you're screwed and they're not, so why should they care? Whereas if something happens to your government on the website, they're going to call us up furious at the house, right, and you're going to lose real time, and we'll have a hearing, you know, something will happen to you. And in one case, you can't offload the risk. In the other case, you can offload the risk. So you just don't care if it's secure. You've got no incentive. So I don't think it's the, you know, magical, if it is the invisible hand, it's giving you one finger. As
So first of all, yeah, to add, I guess I'd add it with Adam Smith. But you do make a good point. But, you know, yeah, banks, they don't, you know, one of the things Adam Smith said is, if there's something, it's not the, you know, the virtue of the butcher that, you know, that guarantees my dinner. It's something out for the self-interest. It's absolutely not the case that the bank, you know, really wants my best interest. But if they're looking for their best interest in a competitive environment that produces the best outcome,
it produces the outcome of them shifting risk to the individual. I mean, come on, can you seriously sit here in 2010 and say the banking system really works?
Well, it works for the banks, but
I'm saying for everybody else.
On topic discussion here.
Yeah, so I think we can sidestep that issue by saying, look at the other parties involved other than the banks in that question. So most of them do have incentives not to lose custom. I think the other interesting thing about this is how much are people using passwords policies to send social messages. So it's a number of times I've come across websites which are really unimportant to me that say, you have to give me 17 different pieces of really strong authentication because I want to tell you that my website is important. So I think there are other things other than the security community, the security people there, but if they're trying to send messages and this, it would be really good to get to interview people who design these.
Yeah.
I think that's ultimately the grand task we have to use.
One, two.
So I wanted to go back to the whole concept of using bit strength as a metric for passwords. And ask whether we're actually just doing this wrong altogether. And it's sort of the combination of Joe's talk and the password strength stuff suggests to me that as a technologist, kind of coming from this as a technologist, I should simply build systems which are not vulnerable to brute force attack and reliably store one-way encrypted copies of brute force resistant copies of the password in a database that the attackers are going to have a really, really hard time getting to, and build a free strikes and you're locked for a period login system. And then brute force attacks are irrelevant, and the only types of attack that will get into these systems are guessing the password. And then we have to, you know, go and look back at the RockU data set to work out what we need to stop them doing to make their passwords so guessable.
Can
but
I throw
bit strength is irrelevant.
Strikes and you're out and make it 10 strikes.
Okay.
Those researchers show
well,
that you're much better off.
It, three strikes if you slow down.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to say on
topic. Can I just say one thing on this strength thing? I mean, I think there's a huge confusion in our thinking on how much strength we need.
Yeah.
Because Unix used to store a password match file a particular way 20 years ago,
yeah,
is not a good reason to be dropping this part of my user's thing. There's a huge difference between online attacks and offline attacks. And I think the difference is segmentation in the histogram that I showed. Guys like Amazon and Fidelity and PayPal said, it's your job to choose a password to protect against an online attack. We make sure that that file match passwords doesn't leak.
Yeah.
Whether .gov says, you know what, I'm just dumping the whole cost of my users, including the cushion of what if my password means. And I think that that's the difference. I think that the guys who are in the competitive environment realize that making it usable is good for business.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Were you staying on topic?
Yes, the lockout.
Yes.
The problem with lockout is that you can do a huge denial of service attack on users.
Say long cap though, I said back off.
Even if it's back off. So what I can do, right, if I were to go after say the 500 million users of Hotmail or Gmail, is I can do repeated guessing on their passwords, and then they're going to fall back to secret questions. And I can do repeated queries into secret questions. So the problem you're going to have is you're going to start locking out your legitimate users, and you're going to have 100 million people who can't get into Hotmail or into Gmail. And then you're going to have the question of, well, what do I do now? Do I start allowing more of these guesses so they can get back into their accounts? Or do I keep them locked down? So, you know, obviously there's other things going on. There's IP tracing and everything. But the lockout problem can actually negatively impact the users.
I disagree because, I mean, a five-second back-off makes no difference to a user, and it makes a huge difference.
No difference.
To 100 million.
No difference to an attacker because they're going to go for all of the users anyway, and they've got millions of IP addresses. So yes, I hit Nico once, and then I go for all the other users, and then I hit Nico again, and I'm only hitting once every hour.
So where's the money in that attack?
So the beauty of that attack is
money,
that no. I'll get there, Gene. The beauty of that attack is that if I want to compromise a lot of the passwords accounts, I've left the provider with choices. They can either lock out their users, which they're not going to do, or they're going to have to relax the security requirements. So then I can get to a higher fraction of accounts than I could before because I'm getting a lot more guesses.
So I guess the only bit I wanted to add was the theme of how does the internet make things different. I think that the main difference with guessing attacks for internet passwords is that you're very unlikely to pick one person and try 10 million things for them. You're very likely to have 10 million accounts, like Stuart said, and try the amount that you can with them. If it's 10 strikes and you're out, then you have 10 guesses in person. That's sort of what I was trying to go for.
Yep.
unsafe sex in its own right, and be more relevant actually to using the internet. Sometimes people seek out entry sites because they're the goods there which they want. I wanted to get to it. My daughter wanted to get to Tiffany Trump, which we couldn't afford. I deliberately went to a site that I knew was not selling Tiffany Trump, and got the same thing for £10. I had to pay £100 for on the genuine site. It arrived from China a week later and is an absolute public replica. I was deliberately acting dangerously in doing that, but because of the rules.
Yeah, I think there are situations where want to do that, and I think that's, I think from, if I want to keep them safe, I think as long as they understand exactly what they're doing, then that's perfectly okay. I mean, actually, interesting thing is that in corporate environments, we've actually found is that you can get a kind of like a corporate bunch of jumpers, people who have a very high propensity for risk and who like to engage in risky behavior. But actually, the social system tends to actually moderate that behavior in corporate environments. Because they tend to normally not want to, if they're taking risks for themselves, they don't want to take from others at risk. And so if you're worried about this type of behavior, then it's always important that people do it, understand that there are consequences for others. And in corporate environments, that's a very powerful lever to moderate that kind of behavior. When you talk about individual consumers, yes. But as long as they understand the risk that they go, you go to that website and you may not get, it may just be a website that has fakes, but that there is a percentage of probability that you don't get anything, even for your £10, and that they're going to use your credit card details on the other side of the same time. So as you understand that, then if you want to do it, that's fine.
But I'd like to point out an interesting problem that I have to answer this question on, which is that sometimes when users engage in risky behavior, they're really not putting themselves at risk, they're putting the entire ecosystem at risk. Because when a machine gets bothered, often the user doesn't bear the cost of that. It's just some of their spare cycles they use up for sending spam and stuff. But the rest of us all have to deal with the spam all the time that comes out of that. So there were a way to shift these costs on the individuals that might incentivize people to behave more responsibly in some situations.
No, I actually don't think you need to shift the costs on it. It's just if you visualize to them what it is, they wouldn't deliberately put other people to speed like risks, even if they don't care themselves. That's only percentage of those sociopaths who would do that.
When we visualize energy use, just making it, just the presence of energy use causes, monitoring energy use causes a good amount.
What I've seen is that's true for Democrats.
Your online bank account, you have to find this
infuriating thing, which of course you've left at home because you need to access your online bank account when you're abroad, and stick your card in it and type in an 8-digit number that's presented on the screen too small for me to read. I mean, the user resistance to these ought to be fantastic. Is there any evidence they do any good at all?
Well, if you speak to the UK payments about it, they will tell you it's been a fantastic success story. That they're basically rolling out, you know, they've got a great reduction in basically certain types of tax on online bank accounts, and that virtually nobody has a problem with it. But basically the attitude here is what if you start doing a little bit deeper off the record, it's the attitude is that they're more or less basically beating their customers into submission. So their attitude is, you know, then that they give a limited amount of support, and then if you don't like it, they're essentially going, well, you know, you're just a difficult person, and if we lose those customers, you know, that's, you know, we lose a few difficult people like that, that's no, you know, who cares? Let those idiots go somewhere else, you know, and use less of yourselves. That's basically their attitude. I think this is an economic problem. Once they made the decision to go for, basically, I agree with you. We've started collecting responses, and a lot of people are furious, and they're confused as hell because different, you know, it's implemented in different ways on different websites. So if you get multiple backgrounds, even if you're a savvy person, you know, people really hate it, but you get a completely different story if you talk to them, just everything's fine.
We wrote a paper about this.
Yeah. So I apologize for blurting out my question earlier, but it's the same question. I mean, if I were to get an account on Rocky, I don't know much about it, but I would assume it's pretty low security, and I would choose a password that's a dictionary word that's the same password I have for like 50 other sites.
And there's also where I'm about to get this password was Rocky, which is probably not shared. And you can see, I mean, the line was a little bit lower than past estimates. There's another reason for that, which is the past estimates were based on dictionaries that weren't specifically tailored to that site, whereas the line I showed was sort of the perfect attack on Rocky. So there's definitely people who use throw away passwords. And I think the JSON user surveys, that number, I think people struggle to do that on a large, I mean, there's definitely people who do that, but there's definitely people who read the same thing everywhere. I don't have a line for Gmail or Yahoo Mail or Mail or whatever, which would be, I would love that data point. My suspicion is that the line would be, the only big difference would be that the very left-hand side wouldn't dip down quite as much, because you wouldn't have the population of people who use something that's really, really awful. But I don't think otherwise it would move a whole lot.
But a quick thing, when that story broke, I thought it was, you know, everybody was saying, oh, look at, you know, these stupid people, what weak passwords they use, you know. And everybody was going like, you know, what's the site doing, you know, have keeping 30 million users' accounts, you know, in the clear. You know, if I was a good friend and I had a very strong password, it would be gone just like that. You know, I mean, frankly, if that's their protection, who cares what your password is saying?
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills every time I listen. By Rocky, because like what percentage of users at Rocky have their accounts compromised because of brute force? We don't know. What percent have their accounts compromised? 32 million, right? So the people who chose really strong passwords suffered exactly the same thing as the people with weak passwords. And instead of looking at kind of stupid users, let's measure the wasted effort of all those people who chose strong passwords to suffer a fate that was common to everybody.
Yeah.
I guess I'm.
Oh, I'm sorry, your arm was somehow just camouflaged against the wall.
So on the theme of bringing more data to these questions, a quick point for Rob and one for Angela. Google has data for the warnings that we put up for search results that say warning this site may harm your computer, about how many people then continue to click onto that site. I would have to double check for what we've shared publicly. It feels probably, but it's something where I think if we haven't shared it publicly, we could probably push to do ad site, right? And figuring out how to potentially separate that out for the people who are actually trying to buy the Tiffany earrings is sort of an interesting challenge. Angela, I wondered whether whether in the studies, in the users and not the enemy studies that you've done, you've had any chance to focus specifically on the set of users who actually are educated, because you sort of raised the theme of the security department going, oh, well, if only users were educated. And I can foresee another interesting paper titled Educated Users Hate YouTube or something.
I think that's an observation I can agree with, because in the study we did in the corporate environments now, it's said generally that the level of awareness was quite high, and people actually knew about federal policies and understood the risks. You know, one of them was a Russian bank, the risks that they were facing. But it was the sheer, in that case, basically, it's the sheer grind of, you know, if you have to authenticate like 35 to 50 times a day, you know, it just would run down. Or when you still find you have, like, you know, when you have your regular passwords and you've done all those, but there's this creep now, all these other passwords you have to, you know, once it comes to the 15, 16, 17, then just go like, you know, I need to get on with my work. So I think it's really, it's if you, I've always said, you know, you need to keep an eye on the user workload. If you don't do that, they can be as educated as you like, and they'll still eventually, you know, just sort of give up and focus on what they need to get done.
What I wanted to point out was that the difficulty when you look at password strength is entirely whether or not you can actually brute force on that site. I measure the strength independently of what anti-brute force stuff is there. It is very misleading because hopefully it means the site should actually consider the two things in conjunction with each other, but also consider whether or not it is easier to set up a paid view. What if you want to steal this Taylor's email address, then you want hers and that nobody else's because you particularly want hers. You just want a random one, right? It is entirely random. If you're just going to use it for setting spam, wouldn't you end up just creating a brand new account and using that for setting spam, and putting your brute forcing out into the ring or character or whatever it is that's protecting it rather than anything else? The second point I wanted to make was that I think you haven't mentioned the very word auditor. Right, because a lot of corporate policies are written by the auditors, not by security professionals within the organisation, but by auditors coming in and saying, we think the standard is to protect yourself so that you can sign your paperwork at the end of the year to say your response to your firm is that you must roll your passwords every 30 days, you must, there must be a strong etc. And people like Amazon and so forth tell the auditors where to get off when it starts interfering in them. Business, whereas whether or not government may not be in a position to do that to their auditors.
So let me just respond to the second part. I think you're right. I mean, your government university sites generally have this awful thing. So there may not be, you know, 10 independent, you know, decisions when you look at the universities. There may be each kind of complying with some policy that's common to the lot. So that's absolutely fair. As to whether, you know, just looking at the policy strength is misleading, there I disagree with you, because I think that, you know, the policy is not necessarily the only line of defense for someone like Amazon. Like, I'm surprised that your study of that, because like Amazon did not have a lot of that for your family. But regardless, they make it work. I don't know, I can't tell you exactly what the fraud prevention policies are at Amazon, whether there's a lot of 10 or 30, or whether after 10 successful attempts they won't ship it to anything other than your home address. I can't tell you what this, but they make it work, right? There's bias in the data is very, very clear that whose business depends on giving people a delightful user service for every login and revenue, they make it work. And the people who really don't have that, they just don't care so much because the pain that they cause users is not something that affects their business. So I agree with you that you know, password strength measure fits is not the be all and end all of all the attackers typically are getting with. But it is a good proxy both for at least the perceived strength that the site is getting in terms of security, and also, yeah, he's the order in this bizarre amount that they did put in the post on the user side.
Are you
quick,
sir?
To your first point about how brute force does exist on the internet, I did kind of a similar paper to Cormac, advice this year, where I looked
just have a slight meta comment. When we were at NSPW, a very nice lady who I cannot remember what she was called said to Cormac, you shouldn't talk about passwords in your talk, because passwords are one of these things where we can't get over it without having confessional moments. Do you remember?
Yes.
And it seems to me that there's an interesting parallel here. The users have to give you these confessional stories about how, you know, I know I shouldn't, but I share my passwords on multiple different websites. It seems to me that as a security community, we might be engaging in the same thing. We've been thinking about this for a really long time now. We aren't really making dramatic progress, but yet we still have to have these confessional discussions around the fact that we can't protect people's passwords. I mean, possibly it was an interesting methodological question for our community is how to, let's say, get closure on the password issue.
Well, at least we're engaging in group therapy rather than doing it in the privacy of a confessional.
This is true. We are the priests.
I think you've actually got a really good point, and it's something, you know, something I've been wondering for a long time. Now, basically, particularly having just done the study and saying, you know, basically, it's just, you know, it's as bad as it was 10 years ago, and it's getting worse. And so this is a different strand of work we've been doing in the Trust Economics Project, which is led by HP. I think the problem that you have is this resistance of replacing a mechanism that clearly is foundering, you know, that's not working anymore, and we're getting to the point where we're getting. But basically, the problem is that a lot of it's the investment you have to make in changing the entire infrastructure to move to different authentication mechanisms. Is that nobody wants to take that basically that money. It's always hard to get out of the, you know, that basically most security people aren't a bit conservative and they like to stick with what they know. But I would argue, and I think some of the modeling we're doing at the moment actually shows that it is for a lot of organizations, the time has come to move to different authentication. It would, perhaps, if you put the investment cost, the operational cost, and the time that your people are wasting on it, you'd be better off losing something else.
We're in the penalty time here, but I'll take one last quick question.
I was just going to say exactly the same thing, which is the box starting very adequately explains my passwords for it, because you can't trust anybody else with this information. But I was going to say slightly different to what you were saying, which is to ask whether things like InfoCard, Microsoft Geneva, that kind of thing, will ever present the kind of usability and consistency which will allow wholesale movement of users to local. They can use local passwords as much as they like, but local consistency for remote security.
I haven't done a study yet. We're going to do a study of InfoCard soon. They're currently doing one on OpenID, and I can tell you that definitely isn't it. Right? I mean, if you think OpenID is the answer to the question, from a usability point of view, it's a disaster. And that's not going to be the answer. For card space, I can't answer it right now.
I had one meta comment on Luke's meta comment, which is TJ Barnum said if you want to crowd start a fight, I think it's security. If you want to buy attention passwords.
Thank you all for being awake on a second morning. We'll start again at 11 sharp.